Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, we round up the week with our favorite Vatican watcher, Joan Lewis, for a peek back at what's been happening here in the Vatican. But first, we present Jill Bevilacqua's program, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Let's listen.
Some Pharisees came up, and as a test, began to ask Jesus whether it was permissible for a husband to divorce his wife. In reply, he said, "What command did Moses give you?" They answered, "Moses permitted divorce and the writing of a decree of divorce." But Jesus told them, "He wrote that commandment for you because of your stubbornness. At the beginning of creation, God made them, male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, and the two shall become as one. They are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, let no man separate what God has joined." Back in the house again, the disciples began to question him about this. He told them, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her, and the woman who divorces her husband and marries another commits adultery."
In their customary fashion, the Pharisees present Jesus with a question, which they hope will trap him into an affirmation or a denial. And Jesus, in his fashion, avoids the trap, asking them a question. The decree of divorce, which Moses had allowed, was only allowed to men. In chapter 24 of Deuteronomy, we may read,
"Supposing a man has taken a wife and consummated the marriage, but she has not pleased him, and he's found some impropriety of which to accuse her. So he has made out a writ of divorce for her, and handed it to her, and then dismissed her from his house."
This law was supposed to deter divorce, not encourage it, for it gave the woman the right to remarry without civil or religious sanction. The idea was that this would prevent the man from trying to take her back after she'd married another man. This is what the scholars tell us.
Moses tolerated divorce as a lesser evil and prescribed the writ or certificate of divorce so as to limit abuses and restrict the practice. In essence, it was a defence of the woman.
But inevitably there were abuses, and in our Lord's time we're told there was much confusion about the grounds for divorce. The rabbis could not agree on what constituted the uncleanness, the impropriety of which the wife could be accused.
There were two opinions. Those following Rabbi Shammai felt adultery was the only grounds for divorce. Those who followed Rabbi Hillel accepted a number of reasons for divorce, including such things as poor cooking.
In 1930, Pope Pius XI issued an encyclical on Christian marriage, Casti Connubi, endorsing and confirming, he wrote, that of his predecessor, Leo XIII, 50 years earlier. And he quoted Pope Leo's words on divorce.
"As nothing contributes so effectively to destroying the family and to sapping the strength of the state as the corruption of morals, it is easy to see that divorce is the greatest enemy of the family and of the state. For divorce is the fruit of depraved public morality. When once facility for divorce has been granted, no curb will avail to restrict its use within definite and prearranged limits. The force of example is great, and the force of passion is greater still. Thus stimulated, the morbid desire for divorce will take hold on the souls of mankind, daily spreading like a contagious disease or like a mighty flood which breaks its banks and overflows. Unless there is a change of heart, family and state must feel themselves in constant danger of a general and complete collapse."
That was 1880. When Pius XI wrote his encyclical, he commented,
"How far these prophecies, now 50 years old, have been fulfilled may be seen in the daily increasing corruption of morals.
What these two popes would have to say about the morality of our society and the facility for divorce can easily be imagined. But there's an interesting note in A Social History of the 1930s by Alan Jenkins. Divorce was nothing new, but it was spoken about more freely, almost with bravado, as was evident in entertainment. In 1921, Clements Danes' play A Bill of Divorcement had a long, successful run. And in 1933, all London was humming Cole Porter's Night and Day from the musical Gay Divorce with Fred Astaire. And to follow a red herring, how did that celebrated song come to be born? Well, it so happened that Cole Porter had been staying the weekend with Mrs. Vincent Astor and heard his hostess complaining that a gutter needed mending. "That drip, drip, drip is driving me crazy," she said, which inspired the opening verse of the song, "The drip, drip, drip of the raindrops." And this led to a refrain that was 16 bars too long, out of vocal range. That, said Cole, was inspired by a muezzin calling the faithful to prayers in Morocco.
Shadows fall like the tick-tick-tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip-drip-drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating, you, 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 night and day.
But back to the state of divorce in the 30s, writes Alan Jenkins.
The divorce rate was falling. In America, because it was too expensive. In Britain, because it was too difficult. One had to go through the dreary farce of staying in a Brighton hotel with a professional co-respondent to prove infidelity.
And there was another thing.
Some of one's friends were the children of marriages made in the 20s, which had now broken up. These children also seemed to be making bad marriages, and some, especially in America, were going to psychiatrists. And so, particularly in Britain, there was a distrust of divorce because it seemed to bequeath its unhappiness to future generations.
As for the unhappiness suffered by those who are obliged to divorce, it's described brilliantly by Evelyn Waugh in his novel Men at Arms, set at the time of the Second World War. His Catholic hero, or rather anti-hero, Guy Crouchback, is in a state of spiritual and emotional aridity when the story opens.
He had no words to describe that wasteland where his soul languished. There was nothing to describe, merely a void. No cosmic struggle raged in his sad soul. It was as though 8 years back he had suffered a tiny stroke of paralysis. All his spiritual faculties were just perceptibly impaired. He was handicapped.
And a few pages later, we're told why.
Guy had married, not a Catholic, but a bright, fashionable girl, quite unlike anyone that his friends or family would have expected. He took his younger son's share of the diminished family fortune and settled in Kenya, living, it seemed to him afterwards, in unruffled good humour beside a mountain lake where the air was always brilliant and keen and the flamingos rose at dawn, first white, then pink, then a whirl of shadow passing across the glowing sky. He farmed assiduously and nearly made it pay. Then, unaccountably, his wife said that her health required a year in England. She wrote regularly and affectionately, until one day, still affectionately, she informed him that she'd fallen deeply in love with an acquaintance of theirs named Tommy Blackhouse. That Guy was not to be cross about it, that she wanted a divorce. "And please," her letter ended, "there's to be no chivalrous nonsense of your going to Brighton and playing the guilty party."
Later in the story, Guy turns the old mosaic law on its head by remarrying his wife, out of compassion, because she is expecting the child of yet another man, and on her death he makes the child his heir. There have been many famous divorces in real life, but none more so than the royal divorce of Henry VIII. However, as the historian G.M. Trevelyan writes,
"The immediate cause of the breach with Rome was not, strictly speaking, a question of divorce at all. Technically, it was a question whether or not Henry had ever been properly married to Catherine of Aragon, since his brother Arthur had been her first husband. A former pope had granted a dispensation for her marriage to Henry, but Clement VII was now asked to declare that the marriage had never been valid, and that Henry was yet a bachelor, for he desired to marry Anne Boleyn."
The pope, as we know, could not and did not declare Henry's marriage invalid. So Henry took the law into his own hands. He ordered Thomas Cranmer to write a treatise on the royal divorce. He was to choose between two verses of the Old Testament, the first from Deuteronomy.
"If brothers live together and one of them dies childless, the dead man's wife must not marry a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother must come to her and, exercising his levirate, make her his wife."
Levirate comes from the word levier, meaning brother-in-law. The practice of levirate marriage became part of the law of Moses because the Israelites felt it was very important for a man to have an heir. And to preserve the property inheritance God had given them, they had to convey it through family lines. For Henry VIII, too, it was the question of an heir that was all important. The second verse of the Old Testament Cranmer was offered was from Leviticus.
"If a man shall take his brother's wife, that is impurity. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness, and they shall die childless."
Naturally, the second quotation was the one preferred by Henry, and that was what Cranmer chose. 4 years later, as Archbishop of Canterbury, he pronounced the marriage to Catherine invalid. As in the Mosaic law, a wife was not allowed to divorce her husband for any reason at all, it followed, as one writer put it, that many women probably fled from unpleasant circumstances without a bill of divorcement. But even in modern times, when divorce is available to men and women, there are those who will flee the conjugal roof without seeking anything more than freedom from the tie. As in this poem by Robert Frost, last in a series of five entitled The Hill Wife. Here is The Impulse.
"It was too lonely for her there, and too wild. And since there were but two of them, and no child, and work was little in the house, she was free, and followed where he furrowed field, or fell tree. She rested on a log and tossed the fresh chips, with a song only to herself on her lips. And once she went to break a bough of black alder, she strayed so far she scarcely heard when he called her, and didn't answer, didn't speak, or return. She stood, and then she ran and hid in the fern. He never found her, though he looked everywhere, and he asked at her mother's house, was she there? Sudden and swift and light as that the ties gave, and he learned of finalities besides the grave."
In a wedding sermon from his prison cell, the Protestant theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote these words, which might sound strange for such a circumstance.
"Live together in the forgiveness of your sins, for without it no human fellowship, least of all a marriage, can survive."
And a similar thought is expressed by the little brother of Jesus, Carlo Carretto.
"Not hoping over the negative in man, only wanting to love the positive in him, sooner or later entails defeat."
And he goes on, referring to marriages that have broken down, when one of the partners complains, "I seem to be married to a stranger, someone I don't know." Carretto replies,
"You have only looked for the positive in him or her. Now you've seen the negative. Everything comes unstuck. The time has come for you to rediscover your partner, to bring your partner to birth from the poor creature's negative aspects. You will see that what is has no connection with what will be, with what is not yet. You must encounter each other in reality, and this is not where you originally met. No one who cannot take this step will ever be able to love his brother for long. But love, real love, begins from here, and from these negative aspects, you have to reconquer the beloved. You end by loving as God loves, loving the negative in man, in the certainty that tomorrow the positive will prevail.
Quite a challenge. And to return to Bonhoeffer's wedding sermon.
Marriage is more than your love for each other. It is not your love which sustains the marriage, but from now on, the marriage that sustains your love.
There's a tendency somehow for us to think that it was Jesus who invented the indissolubility of marriage. But his own words remind us that this is not so. In Matthew's account of this episode, Jesus says,
"Have you not read that the Creator from the beginning made them male and female, and that he said, 'This is why a man must leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and the two become one body? They are no longer two, therefore, but one body. So then, what God has united, man must not divide.'"
And so, as one scholar comments,
"Jesus, with his authority, re-establishes the law of God in its initial purity."
And let's close with the words of another pope on this very theme. In 1789, Pope Pius VI wrote to one of his bishops,
"What God hath joined together, let no man put asunder. Wherefore it is evident that even in the state of nature, and at all events long before it was raised to the dignity of a sacrament, properly so called, marriage was divinely constituted in such a way as to involve a perpetual and indissoluble bond, which consequently cannot be dissolved by any civil law. Therefore, although a marriage may exist without the sacrament, as in the case of marriage between infidels, even so, being a true marriage, it must and does retain the character of a perpetual bond, which from the very beginning has been by divine law inseparable from marriage, and over which no civil power has any authority."
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that program. Well, earlier I sat down with EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief Joan Lewis for a look back at the past week's events here in the Vatican. Come join us in studio. Welcome back, Joan. Good to see you. You and I were in Lebanon at the same time covering the Pope's trip there back in September.
We were. Indeed, we should do a separate show just
on Lebanon.
On that and on some of the behind-the-scenes things, because that type of thing is interesting, too. But, gosh, you look at what we have for today.
I know. It's been a busy week. A lot of things going on. Of course, we had the trial with
the Pope's butler. Mm-hmm. And, you know, either we're going to have to make this show twice as long or talk twice as fast. I don't know which.
Both, probably.
Yeah. No, Two events this week which made world headlines were obviously the trial of the Pope's butler, who has been accused of aggravated theft of papal documents and other documents from the Secretary of State. Many originals were found in his possession in his home. Actually, the gendarmes who were asked at the trial about the finding of the documents in the search reported the figure they used was hundreds of thousands, and about 1,000 of which were directly related to the Pope, to the Secretary of State, with handwriting on it, even in German, "Please destroy." And so the trial is expected to end practically as we're speaking. So we don't have the result of that today. We're speaking just before that trial, the final day, Saturday, and also, obviously, just before the start of the Synod, which we will be mentioning anyway. So the papal butler himself, he testified Tuesday and actually pleaded innocent to the charge of aggravated theft, pleaded guilty to the charge of abusing the Holy Father's trust in him all these years. But it's something that really all of the findings, the documents in his possession, how they got there. He said he did this all on his own. He did not do it for any kind of compensation, money or otherwise. But we've had several hours of briefings, the media has, by eight of our colleagues who have gone every day, the days that there has been a hearing. So hours and hours of hearings, and everything reads like a script for a Hollywood movie, I have to say. So we don't know the result of this man. He was with the Pope 6 years. He is 46, Paolo Gabrielli, a husband and father of three children. So obviously this has to profoundly affect a family. He has been at home under house arrest after being held in a cell in the Vatican. A very sad story, actually. And we'll obviously next week probably be, you know, talking about the verdict. Again, that is expected, as we're saying this, you know, Saturday morning.
Okay, so, and then, of course, another rather dramatic event, unusual here in Vatican, that fellow who climbed up onto the dome of St. Peter's this week.
He did. Tuesday afternoon, he joined a group. I imagine many of our listeners have been to the dome of St. Peter's. When you climb the 320 stairs within the dome itself and get to the top where the lookout is, there's a
railing
mm-hmm. probably 4 feet high or something else like that. And this man was able to tie a rope to the railing. There's security up there. The man put a rope around himself, put a rope around this railing, rappelled himself down to a ledge above a very small window on the dome, stayed there for about 30 hours.
And, of course, he was protesting these austerity measures in Europe.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it had obviously nothing to do with the Vatican, but he's very smart. He knew, if I protest in a piazza in Milan, no one's going to cover me. If I go on the dome of St. Peter's, people will listen to my objections. Anyway, he is back down. He came off on, I think it was Wednesday night, 8 or 9 o'clock. But in the meantime, you had to have the staff of the Basilica, they're called the San Pietrini, the workers for the Basilica, they had a staff of 8 or 10 of them around the clock watching this man. I mean, to see that he wouldn't fall, that he wouldn't faint, that he wouldn't try to jump. So that was the backdrop, the two interesting, unusual events in the Vatican. And then, of course, there was the usual.
So let's talk about the audience, what the Pope had to say that day on Wednesday.
Well, the Pope focused, actually, the audience on the ecclesial nature of liturgical prayer. And very, very interesting, because one of the big things to come out of Vatican Council II, and we're just on the cusp of observing the 50th anniversary of the start of Vatican Council II, one of the biggest things to come out of the council was the liturgy, the changes in the liturgy, for example, to the vernacular and many other things. And so the Holy Father went on at length with some very lovely words about liturgy. And he said, he spoke of the Catholic nature of the Christian liturgy, that despite being celebrated at a concrete time and place, comes from everything and leads to everything in union with the Pope, the bishops, and the believers of all time. And then here's a point that probably a lot of faithful are going to be happy to hear. The Pope said, because of its universality and openness, the liturgy cannot be created or altered by the individual community or by experts, but it must remain faithful to the forms of the universal church. And he said, if the centrality of Christ does not emerge in the celebration, then there is no Christian liturgy. And of course, those were the beginning words. There were references to those priests who might decide on their own. They really don't like the way this or that is expressed in the liturgy, and they may add or their own words, subtract words, or change it, and that is not allowed. But at the end of the audience, the Pope spoke of his visit the next day,
Thursday,
mm-hmm. the 4th of October, Feast of St. Francis of Assisi, patron of Italy, to Loreto. And this was to replicate the journey taken 50 years earlier by Pope John the 23rd, who was going to go there to implore Mary to watch over the council that he had called the Vatican Council II, mm-hmm. the great ecumenical council of beginning in 62, ending in 65.
And of course, Loreto, just to remind people, is on the east coast, the Marche region.
Yeah,
of
on the
Central
Adriatic.
Italy.
Yeah, mm-hmm, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's an extraordinary shrine. I've only been to Loreto once, but it is the Holy House. There's
Virgin Mary.
A mixture of legend, right, and fact, that the Holy House was brought by angels when it looked like it was going to be destroyed in Nazareth in 1290 with the onslaught, you know, of the Saracens. comparisons and so forth. There was actually an Italian family named De Angelis who brought the house stone by stone. It took some time to do. Brought the house stone by stone from the Holy Land, replicated it in Loreto. And this is the house where the Holy Family was to have lived. But a very meaningful shrine. And, of course, the full intention of the Pope, and we can, might as well just move into Thursday's visit. The full intention was to pray for the success of the Synod of Bishops, which, as I said earlier, is about to begin. We're doing this before the opening Mass. And
On Sunday
the 7th, and this lasts for 3 weeks, closes on the 28th of October. And it's the Synod on the New Evangelization. So you've got 200 bishops from all over the world will be in Rome. And the theme is the new evangelization for the transmission of the Christian faith. And it's actually where the faith has already been preached. I know we say new evangelization, but in many respects, it's a re-evangelization, because the goal is for bishops to consider new ways and methods to strengthen the faith of people. So where it already has been proclaimed. Strengthen it where it's weak, or perhaps even, you know, non-existent, or people have tended to put faith in the back of their lives.
So Europe, I would imagine, would be a big focus of this synod.
Oh, Europe, for sure. That is according to many, many things the Holy Father has said recently and others in the Roman Curia. That's probably the biggest area for re-evangelization on the planet.
And, of course, the Middle East as well. I was speaking with the Maronite Patriarch of...
Patriarch Rai
from Lebanon, who's going to be there at the synod, and he's going to be talking about the issues of concerns for Christians, obviously, in a region really under turmoil at this moment.
And that's a region where the numbers of Christians have been diminishing. They don't want to leave their homeland. Who wants to leave their homeland, you know, where you've got your roots and family and ancestors? They don't want to leave the homeland, but in some instances, it's like, oh, my gosh, either stay and face heaven knows what violence or kidnappings or whatever, either stay or leave. So it's not that the faith has diminished. It's that the number of faithful, unfortunately, have diminished, but for reasons which are, frankly, very easy right. to understand.
So how many bishops did you say were going to be coming?
Roughly 200. And then, of course, there's in a synod, there are different types of participants, and the main ones are the synod fathers, we've just said, the bishops, and the cardinals. And the Holy Father has named, I think there's like 46 of them, and the Holy Father's named 36, and the rest are chosen by episcopal conferences. Then there's people known as experts. There will be 45 of those, and they present their different subject areas or specialties at the meetings. And then there's another 49 who are called observers, and they attend the meetings but will not directly intervene. And then, of course, what happens the first 10 days or 12 days, the Synod Fathers get up and speak. They have a certain minimal time limit to their speeches. These are all recorded, of course, and excerpts are given. Usually the media presents those of us covering the Vatican, the Synod every day. And then there's a period where they meet in language groups. They're called circolis minoris. And so you've got, depending on what the main language may be, you'll have more groups in English or French or something. In the end, the Synod Fathers and the participants whose job it is to do this, they present propositions to the Holy Father. From that, the Holy Father takes a year or two to write a document like the one he presented when we were in Beirut,
yep.
The post-synodal apostolic exhortation, which was from the 2010 Synod on the Middle East. So that's a rough outline of what will be happening in the weeks to come.
Okay, well, we'll have you back next week, hopefully, to talk about what's been going on that first week of the
yeah.
Synod. So great, Joan, we'll see you again next week then.
I will be in studio.
Okay, bye-bye. And a very warm thanks there to EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief, Joan Lewis. And I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Laudator Jesus Christus.